To the book of Hebrews chapter 12, and we dealt in the first two sessions on, we spoke about the high priest, and this morning we spoke about some of the practical applications, and this evening I want to speak a little bit more about the practical application of this wonderful privilege that we have of having such a faithful and such a great and wonderful high priest. And so in chapter 12, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 11. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Therefore we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as it seemed best to them. But he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. He begins then in chapter 12, and he says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And he's clearly referring to the people in chapter 11. Now, two things I need to say about that, firstly. The first thing is that I do not believe that these witnesses are witnesses in the sense that they are watching us run. There are so many Christians who seem to have this impression and seem to believe that somehow as I run the race, my grandfather and my great-grandfather who were preachers before me are up there in heaven and they're watching how I run the race. I just don't find that in the scriptures. The fact that they are witnesses, and of course, the way that people, they get to that conclusion simply by saying, well, we have this race, and so you have grandstands, and so you must have these witnesses on the grandstands watching the race. But that's a conclusion which is not there. They are simply witnesses to us. They are witnesses to us, and they are witnesses against us. And so he's saying they ran the race. And some of them ran the race under very hard conditions. And yet they overcame. And when we run the race and we succumb to the pressures of the race and we give up, they are going to witness against us. And they're going to say, we didn't have what you have. We did not have the cross. We did not have the resurrection. We did not have the New Testament. We did not have the Holy Spirit. We did not have the gift ministries. We did not have the church. We didn't have any of the things that you have. And yet we overcame. How come you did not overcome? That would be a terrible witness against us. But at the same time, they're witnessing to us. And they're reminding us of the fact that they were able to overcome, and so we ought also to be able to overcome. And it's interesting when you look, the second thing I want to mention is that when you look at these men in chapter 11 and women, we often hear, in fact today I heard someone refer to them as the Hall of Faith, the heroes of faith. And I've in fact even heard Christians say, well, you know, if you want to know who got saved in the Old Testament, you go to Hebrews chapter 11. But Hebrews chapter 11 does not contain a definitive list of everyone who was saved in the Old Testament. And in fact, it's very interesting, the people that he chooses to name. And of course, he begins by speaking about some of these major figures of the faith, Abraham and Sarah and Moses. But then he begins to name a few names in verse chapter 11, of course, and verse 32. What more shall I say? For the time will fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. And I wondered why he mentions those names. And you'll notice that as you go through this list, that there are some very important names that are not in the list. What about Elijah? What about Elisha? What about Joshua? What about Caleb? What about David's valiant men? There are many, many other greater heroes of faith, in fact, than these people. So why does he choose these names? And look at the first one he begins with. The harlot, Rahab. That's an interesting choice of words. Now we know that was what she was, but that was not what she became. She became the ancestor of David the king. She became the ancestor of Jesus. And it's interesting that he doesn't say Rahab, the ancestor of David, or Rahab from whom Jesus came, but Rahab the harlot. And then the next guy that he mentions is Gideon. Verse 31, Rahab. Verse 32, and then he says, Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah. Who was Gideon? He was one of the judges. He was a man of tremendous courage. That's why he was hiding in the wine press to thresh out the barley. And then there was Barak. We heard about Barak this morning. What was his claim to fame? He wouldn't go to war unless the woman held his hand. And Samson. Wow, there's a hero of faith. The compromising Samson. Why does he mention these names? Because he's reminding us that these men were and women were nothing special. They were just like us. I think one of the wrong traditions we've received of Hebrews 11 because of wrong teaching from Hebrews 11 is that these were these heroes of faith, these men who were in the hall of fame of faith. And that they were superheroes. No, they were just like us. Rahab was a harlot. Gideon was a coward hiding away, threshing his little bit of wheat there in the wine press. And God, in fact, had to give him sign after sign after sign before he eventually got the courage to trust God. But in the end, they all won. In the end, they all became victors and victorious. In the end, they all believed and trusted God. And even Samson, who messed up over and over and over and over again, in the end, he got a glorious victory. And so why is he's reminding us, these people are just like you and me. All we need to do is to trust God. And if we trust Him, He can turn our lives around. He can turn the harlot into the great-grandmother, I think it was, of David the king, the ancestor of Jesus. He can turn Gideon into the man who, with 300 men, defeated 100,000 of the enemy. And God can take your life and my life and turn it around if we'll only but trust in Him. And so we're surrounded by this cloud of witnesses. And so He says, let us, and remember this morning we looked at three things that He says that we need to do. Let us. And here are two more. Let us. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Now, the sin part that we understand, I'm not going to preach about that because you know what that is. But what is the weight? The weight is simply those things that are legitimate. They are permissible. They are not sinful. But they hinder us in the running of the race. There are no rules against running the 100-yard dash or the 100-meter dash with a backpack and army boots and a couple of weights strapped to your arms. There's no rules against that. You can do it if you like, but you'd be very stupid and foolish to do it because you're never going to win that way. And yet, as Christians, we encumber ourselves with so many things that may be quite legitimate, and they are not sinful, but they're holding us back all the time. And he says, let's put those things aside. And folk, you know, sometimes we're so concerned with as long as it's not sin. And so we want to define what is sin. Is having a television sin? Is going to the movies sin? Is this thing sin? Is having this hobby sin? Is playing that sport a sin? No, none of these things are sin. Oh, well, then I can indulge in them. Yeah, you can indulge in them, but they're going to hold you back. Now, I'm not telling you don't do any of these things. But when these things become the things that hold us back and prevent us from running that race. And folks, there are so many things. Our jobs, our careers, our possessions. You know, there's so many Christians who just can't serve God because, you know, I've bought myself a yoke of oxen and I need to go and try them. I've bought myself a field. I need to go and look at it. There's nothing in the Bible against buying a field or buying a yoke of oxen or marrying a wife. But they become the things that hold us back. And I think it's important for us from time to time to look at our lives and say, what are these things that are preventing me from running the race? What are the things that are preventing me from becoming the kind of man and woman that God wants me to be? What is it that prevents me from becoming a Deborah or a Barak or a Samson or a Jephthah? And let me lay those things aside. You know, when I look at Jesus and he's telling us, and we're coming to that, let's consider Jesus. Let me look at Jesus, how he lived his life. You know, Jesus was a minimalist. He just had what he needed in possessions and in relationships, and even in his relationships. The moment those relationships began to impede his ministry, woman, he says to his mother, what have I got to do with you? Now, he was not disrespectful with his mother. But he also understood that his relationship to her could prevent him from hearing the voice of his father and from doing what his father wanted him to do. And so he sets that relationship aside for that moment. And so let's lay aside that weight. Let's lay aside those things that consume our time, that consume our energy, that consume our thoughts, that we worry about, that we really don't need to be worrying about. Let's lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance that race that is set before us. Endurance. That word appears so many times in the New Testament. The Old King James uses the word patience, which is not really, had a different meaning those days to today. Endurance. Stickability. So many times we begin things that we never finish. And I think that as Christians, one of the qualities that we do need to learn, and he's going to speak about how we learn some of these things. One of the qualities we need to learn and we need to develop is the ability to endure. I hear Christians so many times make commitments. And they say, "Brother, you know, I have decided I'm going to serve God with all my heart. Brother, I've decided that I'm going to do this." And because I know some people, I turn to my wife and I say, "It'll last 3 days." Now, excuse me for being cynical. But I've just learned as I grow older that some people easily make those kinds of commitments. Every day we get, not every day, every week we get phone calls at the church. Wonder if you hear what time the services are, what kind of services we have, and so on. And they say, we'll see you. We'll be there. We have a saying in our country, yeah, yeah. Okay. Folk, let's show some endurance. The commitments that we have made today, those who have made some commitment to the Lord this morning, let's show some endurance in fulfilling those commitments. You see, because it's not those who begin well, but it's those who endure to the end that will be saved. And folk, we need to run with endurance that race. It's not the speed with which we run, it's the endurance with which we run. You know the story about the tortoise and the hare, or the tortoise and the rabbit. And the Christian life is exactly the same. And I suppose that fable could have been part of the Bible. As far as I'm concerned, it's as good as scripture. Because there are so many Christians who begin by running the race and they peter out. And yet there are those who just faithfully plod along. And as a shepherd, I would rather have tortoises, a whole congregation of tortoises, than five rabbits who's quick out of the starting blocks and then they fizzle out. So let's run with endurance that race, the race that is set before us. There is a race that is set before you. You have your own race to run and I have my own race to run. Husbands cannot run their wives' race and parents cannot run the race for their children. And the race that is set before you may be a different course than that which is set before the person next to you. And so often we want to live somebody else's life, don't we? We want to run somebody else's race. But you need to run your race in your situation, wherever you find yourself, in the circumstances in which you find yourself. And the problem is that so many times we find our own course where God has put us at that time and the situation that we say, well, you know, this is really a tough course. I think what I'll do is I'll jump over there and I'll run that one. And many Christians do that. And yeah, they're running a race, but they're not running the race that God gave them. They're not running the course that God has set for them. They're running some other course. Now, it doesn't matter how well you run that course. There's no prizes for winning that race. Because that's not the one God called you to run. And so let me run the race that He has set before me. Let me run that with endurance. And then He says, looking to Jesus, the author and the finisher, the beginner, the originator, the alpha, and the completer, the perfecter of our faith. Now, remember, he's just spoken about endurance. What he has begun, he will also complete in us. I'm persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. He is the author and the finisher of our faith. And so we're able to look to him because he's going to be there all the way. He's not going to set us on the course and say, well, I want you to run this race, and then leave us. And then expect us to finish it on our own. No, he is there. And not only is he there, but he is running ahead of us. And so I'm able to look at him. Notice he doesn't say we must look to these witnesses in the Old Testament. We can look at them. We can be reminded of them. But you know, they're not the ones who set the pace for us. Maybe you know in long distance races, they often have a thing called, or a person called, a pace setter. If you're going to try and win a change, beat the record for the mile, or whatever the 1500 meters, whatever the equivalent is these days, the guy will have people who will set that pace for him. And they'll run ahead of him until a certain distance from the end, when eventually he'll run on his own. And he needs to watch that pace. He needs to watch the man who is setting the speed for him. And we have someone who is running ahead of us. And all I need to do is keep my eyes on him. He's not going to go faster than I can handle. And he's not going to lose the track because he's been there before. He knows the way. And so if I can just keep my eyes on him and just follow him, that's all that matters. I remember one time when I was in the military, we were hiking in the mountains, and the mist had come down and it became dark, and we were a long way from our destination. We had one flashlight. I like to tell the story because it's just so real. We had one flashlight. And so the man at the front had the flashlight and had the compass and the map. And we had a rope. And we were walking in very dangerous areas high up in the mountains, and there were cliffs, sheer cliffs, on either side. And so we had to hold on to that rope and just follow the man in front of us. And so we walked, just following the man. You didn't have a clue where you were going, and I remember I was so tired I fell asleep a few times while I was walking, holding that rope. But my job was simply to follow the man ahead of me. I didn't have to think about where I was going. I didn't have to think about anything. I didn't have to make any decisions. All I had to do was follow that man. And he followed the one ahead of him. And you know, that's the wonderful thing about our walk of faith and the race that we're running. We really don't have to make any decisions. Christians get so hung up about how do I make good decisions. But you know, if you're following Jesus, the decisions become obvious because he is leading. And so all I have to do is follow him. The problem is that we want to see the whole way mapped out ahead of us. And he says, no, I'm not going to show you the whole way. Why? Because you'll become discouraged. So all I'm telling you is just follow me one step at a time. And so as I watch my Savior lead me, I just follow him one step at a time, just trusting him. And so we need to be looking to Jesus. Don't look at other people. You'll become discouraged. Because maybe they're doing better than you are. I don't like to look at other preachers very much because I get discouraged and say, Lord, you know, how can they have so many people? How can they have so many blessings? How can they? And I'm trying to just so faithfully serve you, and all I have is a handful of people. But he's never called me to look at them. Maybe I'll be led astray if I'm looking at it. But I need to be looking at Jesus. That's all. It's so simple. And yet, you know, we have our eyes on everything around us. We're looking at all of the conditions and the circumstances and the problems, and we're looking at what everybody else is doing, and we wonder why we get lost. We wonder why we get sidetracked. We wonder why we become discouraged. We wonder why we're tired and why we somehow get overextended and why everything just falls apart. Instead of just watching Him. And as I look to Jesus, He's the beginning and the end. And He will complete that which is begin in our lives. The author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him, endured the cross. Now, last night we spoke about Gethsemane. One aspect about Gethsemane that I have often wondered about, it says that when Jesus prayed towards the end of this time, it says that an angel came and strengthened Him. An angel came and strengthened Him. And I think that that had a very important part or role to play in the victory that he gained over the next 12 hours. And I often wondered, what did the angel do to strengthen Him? And we spoke, I think it was Friday night, about sometimes we want God to give us a shot of courage or a shot of this or a pull of that. So did the angel come and somehow infuse into Him courage? Did the angel somehow give Him a transfusion of strength? What did the angel do for Him? What did the angel do to Him? Well, it doesn't tell us. But understanding the way that God works, I think the only thing the angel could do to Him was to speak to Him. Just speak to Him. And what would the angel say to Him? Oh, don't worry, it's not so bad, you know. Isn't that what we say to one another? In South Africa, we have a saying, you know, the war was worse, people died. In other words, your problems really doesn't matter. It's insignificant. You think that's what the angel would have told him? No. I believe that this is what the angel told him. He reminded him of the joy that was set before him. Because there was one thing that caused him, according to this text, caused him to endure. The contradiction or the hostility of sinners against Himself, to endure the suffering of the cross. And it says it was the joy that was set before Him. The joy that was set before Him. And what was that joy? The church. You and I. Don't believe those people who tell you that Jesus got something after the resurrection that He didn't have before. He was God to begin with. Who is God? God is supreme. He is the highest. So how come, could Jesus get a position that is higher than the highest? Jesus gained nothing out of the cross that He did not have before. Except the church. Sometimes I wonder, Lord, You must be very disappointed. I know He's not disappointed. And so that is what He came for. He came to buy for Himself a bride. And the angel, I believe, reminded Him of the end, the purpose, the joy that was set before Him. And you know, when you look at people, and he's still talking about the race, when you look at the athletes who prepare for the Olympic Games, 4 years, 8 years, some of them 15 and 20 years in preparation to run one race. What is it that keeps them through that whole long, painful experience, day in and day in and day out in the gymnasium, hour after hour on the track, day in, day after day on the road, eating a strict diet, living this incredibly Spartan life. What keeps them going for all of those years of preparation? The gold medal, the prize. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. And folk, I wonder sometimes when I look at the discipline of these athletes who will dedicate their whole lives. And in Australia particularly, they pick these kids when they're 5 and 6 years old. And they put them in special schools where they are trained and they are disciplined day in and day out for the rest of their lives. Until they become 20 or 24 or whatever age, and they are ready to take on the race. What makes them endure? Just standing on that podium, on that rostrum, and receiving that gold medal. That's all. One moment of glory when they play the national anthem of that particular country, and then it's all gone. And so we have a joy that was set before us. We have a goal. And folk, it's when we lose sight of the goal that we become discouraged. It's when we lose sight of the bigger picture that we become overwhelmed. Because the rigor and the stress and the pressure and all of this discipline and all of the stuff that he's going to speak about in a minute, all of these things just become too much. And they crush us. Because we've lost perspective. But you know, every mile that runner runs, and they run thousands and thousands of miles in preparation, he just has one thing in his mind, that gold, that gold, that gold. And Paul says they do that for a corruptible crown. And we're running for an incorruptible crown. You know what? We should be more disciplined. We should exhibit more endurance than all of the athletes that run and that play in the Olympic Games. Because they're doing it for one fading moment of glory. For one gold medal that will melt with fervent heat when Jesus comes. And yet we're running for an enduring crown. And so Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, we spoke this morning about laying hold of that hope that is there, that enters in beyond the veil. Many years ago when I was in secular work, I was tent making. One of the techniques that they taught us in management at that time was when things go bad in the business, or things go bad in your life, what you need to say is, in 10 years' time, will this really matter? Will this really matter? It's amazing how much perspective that brings. So you get up Monday morning and you have a flat, and you're running late and you now have to fix the flat, and the whole world just caves in. In 10 years' time, is this really going to matter? No, it's nothing. It's nothing. And folk, that may be a worldly management technique, but we have eternity. And I think that the question we need to ask as we become overwhelmed by our problems and by our difficulties and by the pressures of life, I need to say, is this going to matter in eternity? Isn't going to matter in eternity. And even when we come to the question as to the weight that so easily besets us, I believe we can ask the same question. Does this count for eternity? This thing that is absorbing my time, that absorbs, taking my energy, is it going to count in eternity? Is it going to matter in eternity? And so I believe that we need to have more clearly fixed in our hearts and our minds that joy that is set before us. We need to, as we stir up one another, as we provoke one another to love and to good works, as we spoke from chapter 10, in that process we need to be constantly reminding one another, Jesus is coming soon. You know, the church in these last days in general has been robbed of the purpose of its existence by those who say that we're building God's kingdom in this world, and by others who are saying that Jesus is not really coming, and by those who say, well, we first have to go through the tribulation before we get to the rapture. No, folk, I believe that the thing that we need to fix our eyes on is to say Jesus is coming soon. Maybe today. Let me have my eyes fixed on that goal. Let me have my eyes fixed upon that, on that reason for which He has called me, on that joy that is set before me. We have that song. I don't know if you sing that song we used to sing it in South Africa. It will be worth it all when we see Jesus. One glimpse of His dear face, all trials will repay. It will be worth it all when we see Jesus. In fact, I believe that what we need more than anything, and you know, I hear about people speaking about the fact we need to have a vision for the church. And I hear teachers or pastors speaking about casting a vision for the church. And I hear evangelists saying we need a vision of hell so that we can have a passion for souls. In fact, I believe there's one vision that we need, and that is a vision of Jesus' return. There is one thing that needs to be our goal. And I'm sorry, I just don't buy into having a 1 year and a 5 year and a 10 year plan for the church. I have one plan for my church, and that is that Jesus is coming soon. And I want to get every one of the people that God has entrusted into my care ready for that day when Jesus comes. That's all that matters. And so as we fix our eyes on Him, who for the joy that is set before Him, endured the cross, despised the shame, and has sat down at the right hand. The word sat down obviously referring In the context of the book of Hebrews, to the priests in the Old Testament who could never sit down because there were no seats or chairs in the tabernacle, because their work was ongoing all the time. But Jesus, having made one sacrifice, has sat down because the work is finished. And so He's reminding us that the time is coming when the work will be done, that we will be able to rest, that we will be able to cease our struggles. A time of rest is coming. My great-grandfather was a great missionary, and he worked incessantly, 7 days a week, never took vacations. And when people told him he needs to take a break, he said, I will rest when Jesus comes. There will be plenty of rest in heaven. And folk, that's the reality. There will be plenty of rest. Unfortunately, as Christians, we've been, one of the things that we've been fooled into, and I'm way off track on my message now, but one of the things that we have been deceived into believing is that Christianity is a cruise. Christianity is a vacation. Christianity is none of those things. Christianity is a race. Christianity is a battle. Christianity is work. Not that I'm earning my salvation, but I'm entering into His labors. And the day is coming that we will rest. And folks, 70 years of labor, or 80 years, or 90 years of labor is nothing in comparison to an eternity of joy with Jesus. And isn't it in these chapters, chapter 12, that he reminds us of Esau? Yes, chapter 12 of Esau. Who did what? For one morsel of meat sold his birthright. He lost sight of the big picture. He lost sight of the joy and the prize that was set before him. And he fixed his eyes on that instant gratification. And he sold his birthright. Doesn't chapter 11 remind us about the men like Moses who saw Jesus afar off? Abraham, who looked thousands of years into the future and saw that new Jerusalem. Looked 2,000 years into the future and saw Jesus. Jesus says, Abraham saw my day and he rejoiced. What was it that made Abraham live as a nomad and as a stranger and as a pilgrim and never own a single piece of land for 70 years of his life, the last 70 years of his life? The hope that was set before him. The joy that was set before him. And he says, I'm not going to settle for anything less. I want that promise that God has made me. And folk, I wish that we could just fix our eyes upon Jesus. That we could just fix our eyes upon that joy that is set before us. And as we do so, that we would be encouraged to say, let me endure. Let me go through these hard things that I have to go through. Let me deal with the chastisement that, and I'm not going to speak about that, but you see the next, quite a section here from verse 5 right through verse 11 speaks about the chastening that the Lord brings upon everyone whom he receives and upon every son. And notice that he says that those in verse 8, if you are without chastening. Now let me just stop. I need to get back on track here. The chastening that he is speaking about here is not punishment. We get this wrong. It's not punishment. It is discipline. It is training. And you'll see that he speaks about those who have been trained. Verse 11, at the end of verse 11 of chapter 12. The peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. God is disciplining us. He is training us. And he disciplines every son whom he received. Now, if you say you're without discipline, like many Christians are saying right now, they're saying we're God's king's kids and God just puts his blessing on us and God just helps, prospers us and gives us health and does all of these things. And God never allows anything bad into our lives. You know what they're confessing? They're confessing that they're illegitimate. Or as the old King James says, bastards. Illegitimate sons. Because if we are true sons, God is going to discipline us. He's going to put us through hard times. He's going to put us through tough experiences. Not because he doesn't love us, but exactly because he does love us. Because during those experiences, what is he doing? He's cleansing us. He's purifying us. He's strengthening us. He's strengthening our faith. He's removing the dross and the stuff that is encumbering us and holding us back. And he's bringing us to a place where our trust and our confidence is in one place only, and that is in him. And it's only when I've gone through those experiences and I've found that I cannot trust in my health, I cannot trust in my riches, I cannot trust in my friends, I cannot trust in my family, I cannot trust in the bank manager, I cannot trust in the property market. There is only one I can trust. That I develop real faith. In the same way as the athlete exercises his muscles. And you know, when you look at these athletes and you see those bulging muscles, how did they get that way? By lying on the sofa and drinking root beer and by pushing themselves to the limit every day. Doing the hard things. And for Christians, are exactly the same. Our faith is exactly the same. You do not develop faith by taking the easy way out. But we develop faith and God develops faith in our lives as he pushes us a little bit further and a little bit further and a little bit further. And you know, he's wonderfully gracious. He's not asking us to to walk on water if I haven't even learned to walk on dry ground? So he teaches me the simple things first. But he's disciplining, he's training, he's working with us, he's preparing us, because he has a far greater plan. And you know, those preachers who are selling people on a good life here and now are cheats and frauds, because they're selling people a lifetime of pseudo-happiness in exchange for an eternity. Now, I don't know about your math, but in my understanding of mathematics, a lifetime does not compare with an eternity. There is just no comparison. And looking over the congregation, most of us don't even have a lifetime anymore. We have a few years. So if you have 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, can we not say, Lord, I'm going to give you these remaining years of my life, because these next 30 years are nothing in comparison to eternity. Let me fix my eyes on Jesus. Yes, the attacks will come, the discouragement will come, the hard times will come. But you know, if I have my eyes fixed on Him, when I have my eyes fixed on that goal, I'll be able to endure those things. When I was, a few years ago, I had a friend and we learned to hang glide. Tremendous lessons in faith. But one of the things that I had to learn was to never look down. Because you're going to go where you look. You have to look where you're going. You have to look at the horizon and say, that's where I'm going. In fact, too many Christians are looking down. And they wonder why they're in a nosedive. Let me fix my eyes on that goal. I don't know if I've shared this with you before, and I trust that I don't bore you with it if you've heard it before, but it's so important. This is probably one of the most important moments in my life that has changed my whole life. I was 17 years old. I had just become a Christian, having grown up in a Christian home. I had just become a Christian, and I'd gone to a conference of pastors in South Africa, in the Assemblies of God. And I was obviously not a pastor, but my pastor took me along. And I sat there and I didn't understand half of what these guys were talking about. And I don't remember many of the things that were said. I have forgotten. But one of the things that I remember and that is indelibly etched upon my soul was on the Friday evening, a missionary lady got up. I don't know who she is. I've never discovered her name. And she sang a song. Just before the ministry of the word, they had a few things, what you call specials. And she sang the song. I've never found the words of the song again. I've looked for them many, many times. I've not found them. But the song said something like this. And this changed my life. And this has become the thing that drives me every day of my life. The song basically said that when I see Jesus for the first time, I will really understand the price that He paid for me. We only have a glimpse of what it cost Him to endure the cross. We don't really know, but that day we will know all things even as we are known. And that day I will have a full understanding of what price He paid for me. And then the chorus of that song said, and then I'll wish I had done more, so much more. Folk, when we stand before Jesus on that day, will we long to say, Lord, I wish I had just endured a little bit more. When we hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant, it will be worth it all when we see Jesus.